Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. It is May 6th. It is Nurses Day. Yay. All right. No one has wished me Happy Nurses Day. Thank you. I just wanted to point out that this is actually Nurses Day, and it is National Nurses Week. And it ends on May 12th, the final day, because that is the birthday of Florence Nightingale. And if any of you know who Florence Nightingale is, she was the English nurse who became known as the founder of professional nursing. And due to her pioneering work during the Crimean War, and that was in 1853 to 1856, she made the habit of making rounds at night, and Nightingale, she became known as the lady with the lamp, and you've seen that neat little lamp, and I should have had one here. That is why nurses are sometimes referred to as the ladies with the lamp. So, anyway, the first Nurses Week was observed in October of 1854. That was the 100th anniversary of Nightingale's mission to Crimea. And then May 6th was introduced as the date for the observance in 1982. So now that I'm a nurse, and I felt that it was really important that we brought that to everyone's attention in the Healthcare Committee. All right, is Alyssa Kenny-Geyer here? Yes. I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 3517 and call Representative Kenny-Geyer, Greenlick, and Gilliam to the stand.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3517A authorizes the Oregon Health Authorities to provide medical assistance on a discretionary basis and within available funds to children under 19 years of age whose family income is at or below 300% of federal poverty guidelines and who does not qualify for the Health Care for All Oregon Children program. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment and no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued.
Please proceed. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, State Representative for House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland, and I'm honored to come here in support of House Bill 3517. Our communities are stronger when all children get the best start in life. In Oregon, approximately 17,600 children are categorically excluded from medical assistance by the Oregon Health Authority. These children, who are in our schools and neighborhoods and are part of our community, have limited options to accessing preventative care and medical treatment when needed. The exclusions undermine the health of all Oregonians. When some children do not get primary care and get the measles or the flu, many are at risk. We have a public health responsibility to ensure and protect the health of all Oregonians and their communities from preventable and serious public health threats. House Bill 3517 does not create any program and does not designate any funds. It simply fixes Oregon's statutes that exclude some of Oregon's children from medical assistance. It gives OHA permission to provide medical assistance to these children within available funds. Untying Oregon Health Authority's hands and allowing OHA to reach these kids help ensure a vibrant community and an upstream approach to reducing health costs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Vic Gilliam, State Representative from Silverton. And in the interest of transparency, I must say this is it's a fairly good bill. But as you probably know, I'm running for Speaker of the House. And I was a mere 59 votes away, and now I'm two closer with the other two representatives. And that it was a big trade.
Don't count your votes yet.
I have no idea why I would set Representative Greenlick up for that, but I did. Seriously, I support this bill, and it's easy to make this bill more complicated than it really is. For me, this bill is simply about children. And there are children that are in our state, but they're also in our schools, and they've gone to school with our children and our grandchildren. They're our neighbors, and they deserve health care just like our own children do. And so it's an easy vote, in my opinion. There are a couple of aspects to this bill that I'll highlight. One is, first of all, this does not have anything to do with your approval or disapproval of the president's health care plan. It has nothing to do with immigration policy of the last five presidents. Again, it's about children who deserve and need health care. And I would say there's another little aspect of this that folks may not have thought of, and that is it could very well help children who get sick here in America when they're on a foreign student exchange. If you look at the reverse of that, my youngest daughter was in Brazil for the Rotary exchange her entire junior year of high school. And I'm very grateful that folks in Brazil reached out to her when she got sick a couple of times down there. Just something to think about, a certain population that this bill, I believe, would also cover. But most importantly, I believe this bill shows compassion, and as I've said before, perhaps the most compassionate state representative that I've ever known sits to my left right here, and I was very eager to join her in this bill. So I hope that the Senate can, like the House, ignore political distractions that sometimes bring out the very worst in us and join together and bring out the very best and do the right thing for kids all over Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick from House District 33. I'm very pleased to be here with you all, with a fine nurse, and with my very own senator. I feel very honored today. I mostly want to echo what Representative Gilliam said. This is a bill about children. And I was asked, what among the things I've done over my last six sessions are the things that give me the most pleasure? And that was an easy one for me. It was House Bill 2116 in 2009 that brought health care to 100,000 kids. Bringing health care to kids is important to all of us, and that's what this bill is about. This bill is about kids, some of whom, maybe even most of whom, have parents who are undocumented in immigration status. But the thing to remember is it's about kids, and it's about kids getting health care. We're not burdening OHA with anything specific, any particular program. We're just saying to them, if you find the money, remember this is a population you need to try and take care of. I think voting for it is an important humanitarian thing, and we'll be working with OHA under the assumption that it passes to help them figure out how to begin to arrange to provide care for these kids. And that's basically all I have to say.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, where did you say you're from again?
Silverton.
Thank you.
But thank you for the question.
Any other comments?
Is that Salem?
Originally my district.
It's true. She represents my district. Also in Oregon.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Greenlick. Stay for your next bill, and thank you. I will also keep that one open, but open a public hearing on House Bill 2551.
House Bill 2551A requires covered entities that are required to file an annual financial statement with the Department of Consumer and Business Services to also file a Protection of Health Information Report demonstrating compliance with federal and state laws protecting individually identifiable health information. It specifies that the report can be a letter and outlines criteria. It states that the report is confidential. It requires that a healthcare facility submit a health information report to the Oregon Health Authority no later than 121 days. Following the close of each fiscal year, and requires OHA to prescribe the form for submitting the report. There is no amendment and no revenue impact, and the fiscal statement was issued.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. For the record, State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which is Northwest Portland, all the way out into Washington County. There was a little mirth on the floor when I brought this one to the House floor because I've been working on this for about 8 years trying to get it in a form that the hospitals and the health insurance companies find acceptable. I think we finally achieved it in this form, and there is, near as I can make out, no opposition from the hospitals or the health plans. The question of protecting personal health information has become very, very important. We, an intern, do some studies to find out the number of personal health records that have been breached, and the minimum estimate is about 25 million in the last 2 years, and the maximum estimate is about 100 million. 100 million individual personal health information that have been breached. Now, this bill comes out of my experience as a corporate officer in a major healthcare corporation. What I know is when your boss asks for something, it's very much likely to happen. And the purpose of this bill is to put the CEO of an organization in a place where at least once a year, if not continuously, he or she asks their chief information officer, tell me about our system for managing the security of our personal health data. Because that CEO is going to sign a form that says he or she has done that, that they are confident in the security of their personal health records of their organization. And it also requires them to certify that if there's been a breach in their system, they've taken that breach on the confidential basis to their own board of directors confidentially, and have worked with their board of directors confidentially to point out what they've done to improve their system to avoid those breaches in the future. None of this information is public. It's just that it's a CEO signature on a form that says they've done these things. There's no civil penalties that go with it. There's nobody's responsible for monitoring the system. It's just for hospitals, once a year, a CEO sends a form to OHA, and for health insurance plans, for hospitals and other health facilities, to OHA, and for health insurance plans, to the Oregon Insurance Division as a part of their regular annual filing. It's very simple. We worked with it over and over and over to get it in a form that the hospitals and the health insurance companies are okay with it, and I suspect you won't hear any opposition to the bill in its current form.
Questions for Representative Greenlick? Thank you, Representative Greenlick, and we will keep this open and come back to it after we hear another bill.
Thank you for hearing.
All right, thank you. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3139A. Representative Hayden. So nice to see you. We missed you last time.
Yes, I missed you. Thank you, Chairman Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden. I'm State Representative from House District 7 today to testify in support of House Bill 3139. To give you a little background on this, we've heard several bills here this morning. The first one talked about children without coverage, particularly in our COFA population. That's a compact of free association for the Marshall Islands, Federated States of Micronesia, and the Republic of Palau. These children used to be covered under our medical services in 1996. The federal government decided not to provide medical services for them. I was practicing clinical dentistry at the time, and some of us in that practice chose to continue to provide services for these patients, even though there wasn't any funding for them. That grew into an involvement into a nonprofit organization, which is currently called, one of them is called Caring Hands Worldwide for myself. That was founded by my wife and I. It currently has locations, three international locations, and provides oral health services here in Oregon. In 2009, we created some clinics that were designed to go to rural communities, provide free oral health, and after 5 years of planning, We were surprised that once the local governments realized what we were doing, permits were not allowed to be had. Due to the population and some zoning, they were able to say that they wouldn't allow us to provide free oral health to the populations in their city limits. After several attempts at that, it was a little bit discouraging because we had put a lot of time in that. One of those clinics actually went to Federated States of Micronesia, where within 6 months I was able to obtain a permanent license and provide health care routinely for that population that got disenfranchised in 1996 by the federal government. This solution we worked with the Oregon League of Cities. It doesn't say that they can't have a permit process. It just says within their permit process they have to allow for the variance for these nonprofit organizations to come in and provide free health care regardless of the population that the people want to provide that for, as long as they're following the regulations of the medical board, health care board, or dental board that they are associated with. It's a very simple law. It's basically two sentences that says that these nonprofit organizations are going to be allowed to do that through a permit process rather than just being told, no, we don't want you to provide that service here. I'd be happy to provide any more information or questions on that. It was amended with the Oregon League of Cities support, and it passed the Health Care Committee and unanimous support on the floor of the House.
Representative Hayden, when I look at it, really all it says is a local government may not prohibit a nonprofit mobile medical clinic from being located on private property with the permission of the owner of the private property and staying in one location for 180 days, 6 months.
6 months, that's correct.
Questions?
It's a good bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that's signed up to testify on this bill? Okay.
Thank you, Representative Hayden.
Thank you. With that, I will close a public hearing on House Bill 3139 and open a work session on House Bill 3139.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hill? Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Knope, would you like to carry this bill, please?
Of course.
Thank you. That'll close the work session on House Bill 3139. And let us resume House Bill 35. There's no more representatives out there, right? Okay. House Bill 3517. Okay, so Alberto Marino, Martin Taylor, and Maureen Hinman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the executive director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. According to a study executed by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, in Oregon, there are more than 17,600 children who face a statutory exclusion from medical assistance provided by the Oregon Health Authority. The current statute restricts OHA's ability to provide assistance to these children and puts all Oregon children at risk. We know that children play with children, and it is in our enlightened collective best interest to ensure they are all healthy. We are here today to ask you to help us remedy this exclusion for some of Oregon's children. House Bill 3517 is a simple remedy which creates permissive language allowing OHA to meet its statutory public health responsibility. There is no budgetary impact. This bill simply gives OHA permission to provide necessary health coverage services is warranted to safeguard public health. We respectfully ask you to pass this bill and ensure that the state fulfills its responsibility of preserving the public's health. Thank you for your time.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, excuse me. My name's Maureen Hinman, and I'm the policy director for the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. We are a membership organization for school-based health centers around the state of Oregon. We do technical assistance and training, policy and advocacy, leadership, and community engagement services for school-based health centers. School-based health centers work to keep kids healthy so they can learn and be successful in school and in life. We have seen firsthand that the health of students affects their performance in school, including test scores, attendance, classroom behaviors, grades, and graduation rates. It's also clear that there are health disparities among the children that this bill is targeting, and that when we talk about the achievement gap in education, we are primarily talking about the same kids that we refer to when discussing health disparities. We are proud to say that school-based health centers work to address disparities by providing services to all kids and all families that are culturally sensitive and respectful of family values and diversity, regardless of their ability to pay. Unfortunately, school-based health centers are not present in all communities and cannot reach all kids. So the Oregon School-Based Health Authority has the vision that all kids are healthy, learning, and thriving. The vision does not change based on the circumstances in which the children live. OSBHA urges your full support of House Bill 3517. Thank you.
Sorry, I forgot to do that my way here. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing CARE Oregon and our affiliated CCOs, Jackson Care Connect and Columbia Pacific CCO. I'm the director of public policy and community engagement. So you've heard a lot of the really good policy reasons. I'm going to just briefly share with you that I have a 15-month-old baby named Wyatt. He's teething, his hands are in his mouth all of the time. So whenever he's around, he's doing a good job of sharing his germs with each of you. And likewise, he's collecting, whether he's playing with the games at Chuck E. Cheese or in his play area at a child care center, someday starting school, he's collecting all of your kids' germs as well. The reason this is an important bill is we do have a public health need. And that is sometimes a need about contagious disease, be that measles or whatever comes next. Sometimes it's also a need that reflects on the fact that kids that don't have any health coverage are almost always in a much higher risk category and frequently exposed to things that Wyatt's not exposed to. Very high ACE scores. Those are essentially the measures of exposure to violence, drug use, neglect. We have kids that have really serious issues and really no system of getting their issues addressed. And those kids are going to not just expose Wyatt to health issues today, they're going to expose him to the issues that come with untreated violence in a child's life. We really encourage this bill to pass as a CCO or a set of CCOs. We recognize that now half of Oregon's kids are in Medicaid. We're taking risk on half of those kids. It is a real problem for us in managing the health of the kids of a community when there's a population of kids out there that aren't getting any care at all and are exposing all of the children that we have risk on to contagious disease and other things that are preventable. So we encourage the passage of this bill.
So in my personal life, I've had families live with me from China, from Korea, from Germany, from Ethiopia, and there have been families with children, mm-hmm. and it has been a problem for those children to be able to get health care. They never lived with me more than 2 years at a time, but still during that time, it's very rare when a child won't get sick. In my community, too, we have refugees, and we have Syrians, we have runaways. We have the biggest homeless. Our schools have more homeless children, and they don't carry their Social Security card or their driver's license with them. And in my district, we have the biggest homeless population. So this bill will affect them also. I don't know if you have any comments on those populations that I'm talking about.
I think that's accurate. We don't live in a closed environment, and so to the extent that one child is unhealthy, as Martin said, creates risk for all of our children. So I think it is, as you heard me say, in our collective and enlightened best interest to make sure that all of them are taken care of. To the extent that these children are healthy, we're all healthy. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other comments? All right. Thank you very much. Next is Tonya Hunt, Joseph Santos Leon, and Jessica Anderson.
Joseph, you've moved parts of the continent there.
Good afternoon. My name is Tonya Hunt. I serve as Executive Director of Children First for Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Children First for Oregon advocates for 860,000 children in Oregon, all children in the state. And we know that health issues know no boundaries. There's not a demographic break between populations of children. They interact at playgrounds, schools, childcare, libraries, grocery stores, all across the state. So we know we can't ensure the health and safety of our children unless we can plan for and address the health needs of all of our children. And this bill simply allows the Oregon Health Authority to do that for all children in Oregon, including critical, urgent, and preventative health needs in the community. So Children First for Oregon urges your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. Sorry. My name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm the executive director of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. I'm also the co-chair for the Oregon Health Equity Alliance, which is an alliance of 41 community-based organizations across the state. We also support this bill. We see this as one of our top priorities for this legislative session. And simply, you know, this really just does grant the Oregon Health Authority the permission to provide services and medical assistance to low-income children here in Oregon within available funds. We know that many of these kids have limited options to accessing care, and we don't need to have the bureaucratic red tape to be able to determine who is and who is not being served. These families tend to be low-income, working-class folks, and they're in every county here in Oregon. In a public health crisis, we need to be able to reach these children with the care they need to stay healthy. This bill creates no new programs and does not cost anything. House Bill 3517 will fix Oregon's statutes that exclude some of Oregon's kids from medical assistance, especially in times of an emergency. These exclusions really undermine the health of all Oregonians, as you've already heard, and we have a responsibility we see to ensure and protect the health of everyone here in this state. We urge your support for this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. As an organization, we fundamentally believe that every child should have a healthy start to their lives. And as an organization driven by our mission to serve the poor and the vulnerable, we strongly support House Bill 3517. As you've heard multiple times, this bill would not require an additional appropriation to the medical assistance budget, but rather it simply and importantly would allow the Oregon Health Authority to provide medical assistance if it can be financed through additional funds. As an organization that's been a longtime supporter of providing care to vulnerable communities, in particular children, we believe that this is a reasonable extension of the authority's opportunities and an important extension of efforts to serve these communities. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some testimony today and urge this committee to move House Bill 3517 forward.
Thank you. Any other comments, discussion? All right. Colleagues, no one has been signed up other than this panel. Are there any comments? We need to make sure that despite the fact that there's no current fiscal due to the recent Supreme Court decision on PERS, the PERS ruling, it's led us, I think, to act very cautiously about potential future fiscals. And so we will be sending this bill to Ways and Means. But I would like to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3517.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3517A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be added.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3517 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be added. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, yes. Just to emphasize the fact that at this point in time with the unknowns, not only in this budget, but future budgets, caution, I think, is very advisable.
Yeah, I wish we didn't have to do this, but I think things changed a lot last Thursday, and I don't think, as much as we all think this is, I think most of us think this is a really good idea, I'm feeling very uneasy about anything that might have potential future fiscal right now. I'm feeling very differently than I did before last Thursday morning. So,
any other comments? Okay, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
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 No.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3517, and then open a work. Wait, we've already done this one. Work session. Okay, we're going to resume House Bill 2551, and we have one other person to testify, Kimberly McCullough.
Chair Mons Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon to express our support of House Bill 2551. Representative Greenlick already gave you a fairly good rundown of how the bill actually operates. I just want to emphasize why this bill is so important. I've provided some written testimony, but I also provided an article to you that discusses some recent very serious data breaches, in particular the Anthem data breach, which was estimated to affect the records of as many as 90 million Americans, and then the Primera breach, which happened after the Anthem breach, actually implicated the records of a number of Oregonians. That breach is estimated to have reached about, or to have affected about 11 million people, about a third of those being in the state of Oregon. Health information is obviously very important to keep private, but there's some aspects of that privacy that are not always obvious, so I want to just highlight those. In particular, whereas when you have your credit card information stolen, you can get that card number, you can get the card canceled, you can get a new credit card. Your health information often includes, you know, information about you as a person that you just can't change. Your Social Security card, you may be able to change that, but it's somewhat difficult to change your number. But also all sorts of other medical information. That information can be used to commit financial crimes, for example, medical insurance fraud or purchasing medical equipment for resale or obtaining medical care for a person other than the person that's insured. These kinds of data breaches often, and when hackers get into these systems, can also end up resulting in somebody's medical history containing false information, which could cause somebody problems down the road. For example, if it said that they had a different blood type than they actually actually have, and then they go seek medical treatment. There could be all sorts of problems there. And then there's just the general obvious risks of somebody's HIV status or their mental health status being released, and there's really no way to make that information private. While all of this is very true, the problem also is that health companies just haven't been able to, they haven't kept up pace with the severity of this risk. So there's a lot of problems with these breaches now because they just, health companies just haven't invested in cybersecurity at a high enough rate. So while this bill won't solve everything, it will certainly, at least as Representative Greenlick said, prompt health insurance companies and health providers to actually be looking at what they're doing and evaluating it with the hope that that prompts some self-reflection and some action. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Comments?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Ms. McCullough, thank you. And I'm just going to say one thing, and I don't mean this to be mean to you or anything. Yeah. I worry a lot when people call out HIV status or mental health status separate from any other medical thing. Mm-hmm. I think that when we do that, we perpetuate stigma associated with these chronic illnesses that are just as serious and no different from diabetes or high blood pressure or all sorts of other things. So I'm going to continue to make this point to anybody who testifies here. I've made this point before, but you give me one more opportunity. So forgive me. I don't mean to bash you, but I want to point out that health information is health information is health information, and it really doesn't matter which chronic illness we're talking about. So I just would hope that as we all move forward talking about protecting health information, which I strongly support, that it really doesn't matter whether it's that I'm concerned about a freckle or I have HIV, right? It doesn't really matter what the issue is. It should be protected.
Yeah, I absolutely appreciate your comments on that. And being a person who has many people in my family and friends group who have both of those conditions, I certainly would love to see our society remove the stigma. But they are, I suppose, examples that people generally use, and maybe we should be reconsidering that.
I hope so. Thank you very much, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2551 and open a work session on House Bill 2551.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2551A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2551A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
No.
No.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields, will you carry this bill? And I will close the work session on House Bill 2551 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2306.
House Bill 2306 grants explicit authority to the Oregon Health Authority to limit providers with regard to which medical assistance recipients may obtain prescription drugs if the recipient meets specific criteria, declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. B.J. Kepner. And is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Okay, Lori Freeman hopefully will be here.
She is.
Oh, there you can come on up too, Lori.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you so much for the plug regarding HIV and treating all health information equally. For the record, my name is BJ Cadmore. I serve as Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are the Chronic Health Collaborative in Oregon. I have concerns about Senate Bill 2306, and I should say we have concerns about Senate Bill 2306 initially because it would limit access for patients to their medication. While we understand that the desire behind this is, of course, to address the issue of drug utilization or overutilization, to address the misuse of prescription drugs and abuse, and to put these things into perspective and treat them as the health concerns that they are. We have had other precedent in the state, specifically in 2010 with CARE Assist, our AIDS drug assistance program, where we've tried to move patients to a mail order only pharmacy, only to be proved to be told that it was not only inconvenient and that patients didn't use this, but it did threaten some of the rights that they have as patients who were using assistance programs. More recently, in a letter of March 31st to OHA Commissioner Lynn Saxton from Acting Commissioner of CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, it was pointed out that freedom of choice or any effort to restrict benefit through managed care entities is not authorized by Section 1932 of the Social Security Act. Specifically, this was in questioning as to what waiver, the 1115 waiver we have, is able to offer. So we understand the intent of this bill. How can we work to make sure that patients are able to get the medication they need without denying patients the medication that they depend on for certain periods of time? And thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions?
I have a question for Ms. Freeman, but not for
okay.
Ms.
Okay. So, Ms. Freeman.
Lori Freeman, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. 2306 has an interesting history. Oregon Health Authority has had a rule on its books for a while now that allows this thing they call the pharmacy lock-in. And if a person who receives medical assistance meets any of the criteria that's listed in the bill on lines 12 through 15, three or more pharmacies in a six-month period, prescriptions from more than one prescriber for the same medication or comparable one, alters a prescription, then they're limited to one pharmacy for a period of time. So, as you know, our office reviews administrative rules in the course of things, but this one has been on the books so long that it preceded me, and so a citizen brought this to our attention and asked us to review it for whether or not it falls within the intent and scope of the legislation. So I looked at our current laws, and we have two laws. We have a set of laws that have to do with drug use review and talks about all the interventions that are permissible if someone overutilizes a drug, and the lock-in is not one of them. And then we also, in the medical assistance statutes, we have a section that says you can limit the utilization for someone whose prescription drug use exceeded 15 drugs in the preceding six-month period. So I wrote a negative determination that this rule was outside the scope of the statutes. So whereas we're often aligning our statutes to conform to federal law, this one's actually aligning state law with an administrative rule, so that the administrative rule will be in compliance with statute.
I understand.
All right, Senator Steiner-Hayden.
Thank you very much. Ms. Freeman, if I'm reading the statute correctly, this is only going to apply to a very small subset of people, because it doesn't apply to anybody on a CCO, right?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner-Hayden, that's correct.
So basically we're only talking about people who have open cards in Medicaid, right?
That's correct.
And that population is a pretty small fraction. I mean, I don't expect you to know this, but serving on the other committees that I serve, I would say that population is a very small fraction, right?
Chairman Sanderson.
Trust me when
Senator
I say the answer is yes.
Okay.
Okay. And then, Mr. Kavner, when you look at the provisions about who would be subject potentially to these restrictions, these don't strike me as by any means the average patient. I mean, as a physician, when I read these things, I get really nervous about people who meet these criteria. They are not doing themselves or anybody else any favors with how they're using their medication, and they're not promoting their health. I fully support your point about retail pharmacies versus mail order. And in fact, this committee passed out a bill fairly recently that then passed the Senate floor and is going across to the other side, hopefully to have some minor amendments, to require that people be able to fill their prescriptions at a retail pharmacy for a 90-day supply for exactly the reasons you discussed. But if I had somebody who was shopping around in multiple pharmacies with multiple prescriptions from multiple providers, I'd worry about their health and well-being. And so I'm kind of wondering if you could help us understand a circumstance where somebody who met all of these criteria would be better served by not having this restriction. Normally, I agree with you about 90% of the time. This one I'm not so sure about.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you. We are an organization that provides advocacy for people living with chronic health conditions. And chronic health conditions are generally treated by multiple medications. Patients are often, if not borderline, then very polypharmacia, meaning taking more medications than one. With regard to the number of people who would be impacted by this, yes, you are correct. It is the open card patients on Medicaid, and they are small. However, we are still concerned about the actual patients and their access. With regard to when this could be an issue, this could be an issue if a patient is released from an emergency room, is going to a pharmacy near there to get a medication, has a regular retail or mail order pharmacy, and needs something that's compounded. So that's an example. The issue is not, we want to make certain that we are addressing the issue of doctor shopping. We have the PMPD in place, and we've closed the loopholes necessary for that to identify people who are doctor shopping, who are looking to misuse prescription medication. Our concern with this is that patients are able to have access to their medication without any type of unnecessary barriers. And again, that if we think that someone is doctor shopping, if we think there's a utilization, we believe it's the responsibility of the pharmacist and the provider to discuss that with the patient. And we'd like to keep the OHA out of that, if possible.
Follow-up, Madam Chair? Thank you very much. I hear you loud and clear, Mr. Kavner. I guess what I'm seeing here is permissive language, not requiring. This is a may and not a shall in line 8 on this. And, you know, it says, if necessary to avoid overutilization by a recipient, Section 2, by a recipient of medical assistance, the Oregon Health Authority may restrict for 18 months or less the recipient's pharmacy choices for filling and refilling, et cetera, et cetera, if the recipient uses 3 or more pharmacies in a 6-month period. And you pointed out a situation, but I think that's a time when, within a pretty broad, if they knew somebody had been to the emergency department, had to get something filled quickly, and normally used a regular retail pharmacy and a compounding, I would be dismayed if that was the time when they chose to invoke this opportunity. Fills prescriptions from more than one prescriber for the same or comparable medicines, or alters a prescription, or exhibits behaviors. These are all or statements.
Mm-hmm.
In each case, I think the health authority has some discretion here, if somebody gets a temporary prescription for a hypertension medication from an emergency room and then gets the same prescription from their primary care provider, I'd be surprised. In fact, I'd be dismayed, as I said, if the health authority invoked their right to do this for that patient. But I hear your concerns. I guess I just don't share them in this particular case.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, we both live in the belief that people do the right things all the time for the best outcome, and unfortunately that's not often the case. And again, we do advocate on behalf of patients, and patients often don't have the loudest voice, especially sometimes when they are feeling ill, and I agree with you. And if I may be flip for a moment, we did propose a solution to this, which was the medication synchronization bill, which would have allowed everybody to see what a patient is getting.
We're working.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, one more thing. I would say this, Mr. Kavner. I will make you a promise, which I don't do often from this seat, that if you hear real evidence, if this bill passes and you hear real evidence that the health authority is abusing this prerogative, I want to know about it, and I'll work with you on it. Okay?
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. I accept that promise, and I hope we don't have to work towards it. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Okay. Thank you. Does the health authority, someone from the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, or anyone like to just put a statement on the record?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Weatherson, and I'm with Medical Assistance Programs. And my understanding about this is that the pharmacy management program was approved by CMS through state plan amendment in January of 2012. As you've already heard, Legislative Council issued a negative determination regarding our OAR's administrative rules regarding this. And we believe that House Bill 2306 resolves the issue. It gives us the legislative authority to move forward with the pharmacy management program.
Great. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I tried to look at this before coming into committee, but the mechanics of this, how will OHA stop this from happening if they've determined that somebody is drug-seeking?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I will need to get back to you with that information about the particular mechanics of how OHA would stop this.
Okay. So we're not moving this today then? Okay. Thank you.
So if you could maybe get back to the committee on that, we won't move the bill today, but we will address it when we get just a little bit more information.
Thank you.
To
Madam
us.
Chair?
Yes.
If you could also get us information on how often this authority has been exercised during the period of time that the health authorities had the rule, that would also be helpful to the committee, and what your population is of people to whom this would apply. I think that will be helpful for the committee in determining whether we have a real concern here about risk of access for patients who need significant, who have significant needs. That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And
all right.
If
yes.
I
mm-hmm.
could make a request of Zena, would you mind uploading it to OLIS so that we have that available for the next time?
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2306 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2541.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2541A requires a physician, physician assistant, or an individual licensed to practice nursing to be present at blood drives. It requires a qualified person to be present during the donor intake and screening process, but does not require the professional to conduct the intake. It specifies that if a qualified person is unable to attend the blood drive and 48-hour notice is given, the donor site must make a reasonable attempt to replace the individual. It requires the donor site to keep a record of the qualified individual's schedule. There is a fiscal impact issued and no revenue impact.
Okay, Jen Baker, Dr. Mary Jo. Representative Doherty and Representative Newt Bueller, please come forward. Thank you for waiting so patiently.
We are anything but patient.
I'm not sure how patient they were. They were just gossiping back there. They weren't paying any attention to what we were doing.
Margaret was telling me stories.
Okay, thank you, Senator Moynihan Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty, and I'm the House representative from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And we are here today to talk about House Bill 2541A, which is what we refer to as the blood bank bill. Oregon has resisted the national shift away from using registered nurses and licensed personnel in their blood mobiles in the blood banks, and what we are asking for today is to make sure that registered nurses continue to be the personnel that run blood mobiles. House Bill 2541A will ensure that high donor safety standards that have long been in place in Oregon will continue. I think the one thing that's very important about our state is we do look at consumer protection. We look at protection of a lot of our folks, and this is one bill that will continue it. Oregonians have come to expect the high standard in blood mobiles, and a statewide poll currently that was conducted by Triton Polling and Research found that 82% of Oregonians would be less likely to donate blood if a nurse were not present at the drive. What you have before you are the -6 amendments. and that have been adopted. And what it is, it's an amendment was adopted in committee to address the concerns regarding the possibility of blood drives, especially rural blood drives, that an RN has had to cancel. And so what we have is that if there was a short notice and they could not get another RN to come in, it allows the blood drive to continue if the qualifying provider who was scheduled to staff the drive cancels with less than 45 hours notice and a replacement is not found. They pretty much just put up a sign and to notify people that a registered nurse would not be there. This was a bill that was fully vetted in the House, and it's one that we believe is very good for the people of Oregon and to continue blood drives and continue the very important business that they do. So with that, we'll get the technical
Thank
side of it.
Thank you, good representative. For the record, my name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And I was also a member of the House Health Care Committee that heard testimony on this bill. I want to give you just some personal insight with regards to the blood drive. Since being a physician and surgeon, I use their good services quite often. And unfortunately, I have to report that that has not been a great experience for myself and my patients. I've received numerous complaints over the years about poor standards, lack of professionalism, not keeping a schedule, even with regards to the hygiene of many of the Red Cross blood drives. I've personally contacted administrators at Red Cross. I've sent letters. I've met with them on numerous occasions and continue to get complaints. And this is just not a one-off anecdotal problem. There's been well documented nationally with the Red Cross undergoing decades of problems, multiple attempts at the FDA to intervene and tighten up these processes at blood drives, including federal court orders, millions of dollars in fines, and even an FDA commissioner taking the rare step of meeting personally with the Red Cross board of directors to tell them what a problem this is. Now, of course, nurses simply being a president of blood drive somewhere in Oregon is not going to clean up these systemic problems with the Red Cross, but I think there's definitely help is needed and a higher level of professionalism is clearly needed with the blood drives. I think this bill will at least make a small step in that improvement. So thank you very much, and I urge your support.
Yeah, open for any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now Jen Baker, Dr. Mary Jo Drew, and is it Matt Clark?
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, happy Nurse Week. Jen Baker testifying on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of House Bill 2541. The Oregon Nurses Association represents over 13,000 nurses throughout the state that make up the largest segment of Oregon's healthcare workforce and practice in a variety of settings, including 40 nurses here in Oregon who work on blood drives. And the Oregon Nurses Association has had in place with the American Red Cross a contract that states the Red Cross here in Oregon will make their best effort to have a nurse present on every blood drive operated in the state. It is our understanding is that's happening 90 to 95% of the blood drives being operated in Oregon. So this bill is really about holding a standard in place that we've had here for a while. And the Red Cross has done a great job of demonstrating that that standard can be in place without compromising the blood supply or Oregon's ability to operate blood drives. And the real problem is an additional blood collection organization that is now operating drives here in Oregon that does not have any sort of agreement or internal policy of utilizing nurses. What we've seen in the blood collection industry, Representative Bueller touched on this a little bit, is just a lot of changes in medical advancements and evolving best practices, and folks aren't utilizing, physicians and surgeons are not utilizing blood transfusions as much as they once needed to. While this is generally really good news, it has definitely posed some problems and some challenges for blood collection organizations as a whole. And the response that we've seen throughout the country is cutting budgets, cutting staff, and primarily cutting the most expensive staff out of blood drives. That has traditionally been nurses. And relying solely on assisted personnel to operate blood drives. And while Oregon's nurses value the role of assisted unlicensed personnel in a variety of settings and certainly value the work that their colleagues do at the American Red Cross on blood drives and recognize that they do serve an important role in that setting, we do not believe that it is appropriate to have solely rely on those folks without supervision, on-site guidance there. And I will refer you to a letter that was submitted from workers at the American Red Cross who are colleagues of the nurses who work there. It was submitted to the House Healthcare Committee supporting this legislation, highlighting what a valuable asset it is to have nurses to assist them with blood drives. Also in OLIS today for you is an opinion from the Oregon State Board of Nursing. And while Oregon nurses believe that donors deserve immediate and quality attention if there are ever adverse reactions experienced on a blood drive, and that is an important role that nurses play on blood drives, it's not the sole role of a nurse on a blood drive. The intake process is often a simple set of yes-no questions, but if more complex cases present, it automatically becomes an assessment, and that's what the Board of Nursing explains in their and their testimony for you today. A comprehensive assessment nurses are trained to do. They synthesize biological, physical, psychological, social, sexual, economic, cultural, and spiritual aspects of a client. They are also trained and educated to do focused assessments, which is an appraisal of a client's status and situation at hand through observation and collection of objective and subjective data. And they are educated and trained to anticipate changes or potential changes in a client's health status based on that information that they collect. And nurse assessment, whether it be comprehensive or focused, remains firmly in the purview of nursing practice. And therefore, anything outside the yes-no question on donor intake needs to be directed to a nurse to conduct an assessment and make a decision whether or not that donor can safely donate blood. Dr. Bueller touched on some of the trouble with the FDA regulation of the Red Cross and other blood bank collection agencies. I will also refer you to my written testimony, which has a link of a timeline of the last 15 to 20 years, some of the things that we've seen, citations and violations issued against these organizations, and many of them highlight inadequate training of staff and understaffed sites as a problem in for the citation. And then I will end by saying that this is an A and Gross version is a compromised bill. Initially, there was no the amendment adopted allows a 48-week period cancellation. So if the nurse or other licensed provider that was scheduled to work the drive cancels with less than 48 hours notice, the blood drive can continue. This was a compromise, ONA recognizing that there needed to be some flexibility for these organizations to conduct their business, some flexibility for the co-workers of our nurses at the Red Cross and for rural communities. The posting requirement that Representative Doherty mentioned is actually not in the amendment that was adopted. It was discussed in the House, but ultimately did not make it into the A and Gross version. So ONA supports the A and Gross bill as in the spirit of compromise and recognition that it does move the dial forward in ensuring that more drives here in Oregon have nurses staffed on them, and we urge your support.
Thank you.
Hello, good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, committee members. My name is Dr. Mary Jo Drew. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for the opportunity to submit testimony in support of House Bill 2541A, which would require an RN or other licensed healthcare professional to be present on blood drives. I will be speaking in support of this bill.
I'm a board-certified clinical laboratory pathologist and independent consultant with 27 years' experience in transfusion medicine. Most recently, I was medical director of the Portland Red Cross from 2007 to 2013. I've also directed multiple large hospital transfusion services and other regional blood collection centers. As was alluded to just now, there have recently been major changes in the donor blood collection industry that have been driven by declining hospital blood usage, both for reasons of economy and reasons for patient safety on the part of the hospital. A critical mass of published data has, over the last 5 to 7 years, become available that indicates that transfusing less, particularly less elective transfusion, means better outcomes for many patients. Blood centers are thereby realizing less revenue. Staff layoffs, of course, have occurred as one form of cost-saving measure. My concerns with the Red Cross plan to eliminate licensed medical staff from blood drives are twofold based on my experience of 6 years with the organization, the safety of the blood being collected and the safety of the donor in the event of an adverse reaction. Now, a prospective donor can present with a health or medication issue for which donor eligibility requirements may be somewhat complex or may seem unclear to the person who's doing the health history screening. Now, that non-licensed staff member may be very well trained in routine Q&A health history questionnaires, and I saw that in my time with the Red Cross. However, having a licensed health professional immediately available, this individual who has the education and knowledge to assess whether a donation is safe, both for the donor and the recipient, would allow for much more prompt resolution of whether or not that donor is eligible and is a safe donor. The vast majority of blood donors, very fortunately, have no ill effect from donation whatsoever. But as we all know, between 2 and 5% of donors may have a reaction that range anywhere from simple lightheadedness that doesn't really affect them all that much to a loss of consciousness with the consequence of possible injury. High school and college-age donors who contribute around 20 to 25%, depending on the part of the country, of the blood supply, may be especially prone to these fainting reactions. Non-licensed staff, in my opinion, and based on my experience visiting almost 50 blood drives during my tenure with the Red Cross, should not be placed in the position of trying to make a decision about emergency transport. Should I call? Should I not? Trying to have to broker this over the telephone with either a nurse or with a physician on call, as I had to be involved in many times. Sometimes I've observed that the unlicensed staff is concerned about two things. Either, number one, am I going to overcall this issue as far as severity is concerned? Do I really need to call the ambulance? Or of missing something important because they recognize themselves that they might not have these critical assessment skills. So all that says is that having a licensed medical staff member on site can help make a sound decision in these situations where, even though they're extremely rare, time is really of the essence in getting triage and treatment and referral to a healthcare facility done if that is necessary. It may amaze you to hear, maybe not, that over 25% of us are going to require blood transfusion sometime in our lives, everybody in this room. So look around you here. I mean, this could be anyone. It could be you, your spouse, partner, your colleague, your child. So what I would ask the committee to consider is that plea to help us assure, for the various reasons that have been already discussed, that cost savings don't take a priority over both blood donor and blood recipient safety. And having said that, I urge your support of House Bill 2541A. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Matt Clark. I'm a registered nurse, and I've worked at the Red Cross Blood Services for over 15 years. I'm very proud to work at the Red Cross. Many of my family members have been blood recipients. My work allows me the opportunity to give back to my family and community by helping to protect the integrity of the blood supply. In my career, I have supervised staff and volunteers to ensure safe, efficient blood drives, performed venipunctures, and assessed potential donors for their ability to give a viable and safe unit of blood according to preset criteria. Unfortunately, there is no such thing as a safe blood supply that is 100% safe. All we can really do is to make sure that it is as safe as humanly possible. Having one formally trained, licensed healthcare professional on site at each blood drive helps keep us much closer to that realization. For example, I remember a blood drive where I was the only nurse, and I had just returned from a break when I discovered a donor with a severely smashed and cut thumb. He didn't think it was infected, and nor did it show any signs of infection. But when compared to his other thumb, it was clearly like twice the size, twice its normal size. Three non-licensed staff, plus the team supervisor, had decided it was safe for him to donate blood. Any infection may not have been growing, and an infection may not have been growing in his thumb, but we did not know that for sure. And he was not taking an antibiotic. It was certainly not worth risking a blood recipient's health. And by the way, the on-call physician emphatically agreed. This is only one small example of how the presence of even one health professional on site can have a potentially huge impact. In this scenario, my coworkers could have called the physician, but they did not fully understand the risk involved in the blood to the blood supply. As nurses, we have education and training in disease processes, pharmacology, and assessment skills. Nurses bring experience and expertise that blood collection organizations cannot teach during their limited trainings. Sometimes a nurse's job is as simple as knowing when to call a physician or paramedics for their life-saving equipment. Not long ago, half the staff on every blood drive were nurses. Then, only nurses were trusted to determine donor suitability. Now, the nurse's presence has been cut to the point where sometimes there are no licensed personnel at all. And so I request your support of HB 2541A to ensure that at least one licensed healthcare professional is on site at every blood drive in Oregon.
Thank you. I do have one question. You had alluded to some problems across the nation, but do we have specific examples in the state of Oregon of complaints?
Senator Mona Sanderson, I do not have any in the state of Oregon. We do have some information about Washington State, but nothing here in Oregon. That's not to say it doesn't exist, though.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And Jesse O'Brien. And then I'll have the last three come up. Oh, and Rich App.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I'll be very brief. OSPIRG supports this bill. We think it's an important consumer protection measure. I won't belabor the case for the bill, which I think was made very eloquently by the previous testimony. I think we've seen through both the polling that was mentioned in previous testimony and in the response we've seen from our own members on this issue that the public really does expect to receive the level of care that they get from a nurse or other licensed healthcare professional when they are giving blood, and we would like to maintain that here in Oregon. We think it's an important consumer protection and an important protection for the safety of the blood supply here in Oregon. I also want to emphasize again that this bill is in some respects a compromise. We really supported the idea of requiring a public posting when there wasn't a licensed healthcare professional available on a blood drive, but that raised some concerns for stakeholders, and so that proposal was not included in the A and Gross version of the bill, which is before you today. But we still support the bill, and we hope you'll support the bill as well. Thank you.
Chair Amanda Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Rich App. I've been a registered nurse for 30 years, and I practice in a variety of settings, including 18 years in the apheresis platelet collections at the American Red Cross in Portland. I am honored to serve and provide quality nursing care to Oregon residents who selflessly give the gift of life. As an Oregonian, I am extremely proud of the unique way Oregonians continue to work towards progress and set national trends. Oregon's citizens embrace being unique and are not afraid to think differently about how to best serve public needs. As a nurse in the blood drive industry, I'm excited to see Oregon working to improve standards for donors and protect Oregon's blood supply with House Bill 2541. I'm extremely proud of the bipartisan support this bill received in the House. A 2013 poll conducted by Triton demonstrates that most Oregonians agree that every blood drive conducted in Oregon should have a licensed care provider present. 73% of the Oregonians polled would feel less confident about the safety and security of the blood supply, and 82% would be less likely to donate blood. Oregonians were willing to sacrifice a pint of blood and their precious time deserve nursing care. The national trend moving away from the use of nurses on blood drives is happening due to changes in the blood banking industry, better blood management by doctors, evidence-based medicine, and new innovations has lowered the demand for donated blood. As a result, blood collection organizations have become more competitive and have decided to make cuts to budgets, lay off staff, and a shift towards the use of non-licensed personnel exclusively. This is not the proper way to handle the changing landscape. In Oregon, we have resisted this trend to some extent through an agreement between the Oregon Nurses Association and the American Red Cross. Approximately 95% of Red Cross drives operated in Oregon have a nurse present, demonstrating this policy can be implemented without placing an undue burden of blood collection on blood collection organizations or the Oregon's blood supply. Nurses are essential to blood and blood donor safety. We assist non-licensed staff with the donor assessment process. We use our professional experience and skill to help answer complicated donor acceptability criteria questions. Nurses are trained and are able to respond to any unfortunate reactions that may occur during the blood donation process. Nurses are essential to helping donors recover safely. Donors in Oregon trust that they will be cared for. Oregon must continue to buck the national trend of eliminating nurses from blood drives and pass House Bill 2541. Donors who step up to the plate to give the gift of life deserve quality nursing care when it is needed. Thank you for letting me give a presentation.
Thank you
presentation.
So much for coming. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Hank Hanna, John Kelly, and Drew Hagedorn.
Chair Monis Anderson and the members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, my name is Hank Hanna. I'm the medical director for the American Red Cross Pacific Northwest Blood Services Region. House Bill 2541-A would not enhance donor safety or the safety of the blood supply, and it would place unnecessary constraints on the blood collections in Oregon. The top priority of the Red Cross is the safety of the donors and the blood product recipients. First of all, the blood collection organizations are regulated by the FDA. All blood banks, including the Red Cross, are subject to regular inspections by the FDA and the AABB. In addition, the Red Cross has its own internal auditors for all processes and procedures associated with blood collection, including donor complication management. Second, the Red Cross extensively trains and assesses the competency of its workforce to ensure compliance with the regulatory requirements of the FDA as well as its own high standards of performance. Moreover, each Red Cross service region has dedicated physicians available 24 hours a day to consult with any medical concerns relating to blood drives. Our donor and client support center is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week as well, with specialists who are able to provide telephone consultations to collection staff regarding any matter that may arise at blood drives. We also provide toll-free telephone consultations to donors that may have questions or concerns after leaving the blood drive collection site. For donors who may have contacted our center, the staff remains in contact by phone or by written communication until the matter is resolved. Red Cross physicians are available to assist the center staff 24 hours a day as well. And finally, the Red Cross tracks donor complication data through the Red Cross Hemovigilance Program. There are some variations among Red Cross regions, with most donor complications being mild in nature and brief in duration. The chart submitted with my written testimony shows major donor complication rates across the National Red Cross system are low, ranging from 10 to 25 reactions per 10,000 donations. In fact, donor complication rates in California and the Pacific Northwest, where Red Cross deploys licensed staff on blood drives, are near the upper end of that range. While the rates vary from region to region, the data from the Red Cross Hemovigilance Program show that regions with unlicensed collection staff have a similar or lesser rates than of donor complications as those regions with a combination of unlicensed and licensed staff. So there's simply no evidence that supports the contention of enhanced safety by having licensed staff on hand at blood drives. Therefore, the Red Cross opposes House Bill 2541-A, as it would not enhance donor safety or the safety of the blood supply, and it would place unnecessary constraints on the blood collections in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. Good afternoon. Chairman Anderson and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, my name is John Kelly, and I'm a collections manager for the American Red Cross Pacific Northwest Blood Services Region. I'm here today on behalf of the Red Cross to oppose House Bill 2541A, which would reduce access to blood drives in support of patient needs without evidence of improvement in the quality of safety of blood drive operations and would increase healthcare costs passed on to consumers in the state of Oregon. House Bill 2541 was amended, and that included a provision that blood drives could be held as scheduled without the presence of a nurse if the nurse calls out with less than a 48-hour notice. While this does offer some relief to the restrictions, it still presents operational challenges, and that will directly lead to the cancellation of blood drives or the suspension of blood collection operations entirely in parts of the state. In general, it takes 4 to 6 months to recruit a nurse and 3 months to fully train staff for a total of up to 9 months before a position is filled by a qualified individual. Rural areas can be very challenging. In fact, one of the last open nurse positions in Bend took 125 days to fill. A recent position in Roseburg took 135 days to fill. It has taken more than a year to fill an open nurse position in Klamath Falls. Long-term vacancies will result in the suspension of blood collection activities in those areas and will directly impact blood availability to Oregon hospitals and the patients in need. In addition, staff schedules 4 months in advance. So cancellations with just a 48-hour notice will not help reducing the significant impact of these call-outs. Every day, the hospitals that we serve rely on consistent ability for us to provide the blood products that are needed for their patients, and it is crucial that we do not have an interruption in our blood supply because it is a perishable product with a limited shelf life. Imagine the amount of work that goes into to plan blood drives and these blood donor chairpersons signing up donors, recruiting committed volunteers to assist on these blood drives. When a nurse is not available, we would then need to cancel that blood drive, and we can't find a replacement nurse in time in order to run those drives. Our blood donors are affected. Usually we're looking at about 30 at each blood drive, and that creates problems in and of itself. It's unlikely that these donors would want to reschedule and come back to the Red Cross. It impacts our staff members who may seek jobs elsewhere because of the change in their schedules. It's also unlikely that we'll be able to meet the hospital demand for blood. Through our collective bargaining agreement with the Red Cross and the Oregon Nurses Association, we have consistently maintained 90% of blood drives with a nurse on them. We consistently schedule 100% with a nurse, but due to unplanned absenteeism and turnover rates, this equates to that 90% coverage. It is already challenging enough to collect blood to meet patient needs, but particularly in the winter and summer months, and anything from severe weather to school breaks or holidays can affect our ability to collect. with this bill and the mandate of a licensed staff person on each blood drive, this creates another significant obstacle to ensuring patients have the blood they need when they need it. We would not need to reduce the number of technician. Well, we would actually, need to reduce the number of technician positions to account for an increased number for nurse positions. In addition, when a nurse is not available or is taking medical leave, another nurse would need to be relocated to ensure that we are not forced to cancel that blood drive. If no other nurse is available, technicians scheduled to work that blood drive are also impacted. They would miss out on that day or possibly future days of work. And this, again, affects the employee's quality of life. Potential impacts for jobs in Oregon are significant. The transfusion medicine and the blood banking industry is a very competitive one. And as hospital systems consolidate to meet the requirements of a cost-effective healthcare model, blood centers are responding with consolidation of their own in order to serve across multiple states and geographies. Blood centers will collect blood where it is least expensive to do so and distribute blood wherever it is needed. House Bill 2541A would do more to increase the cost of collecting a unit of blood in Oregon and likely have unintended consequences. As collections are reduced to offset expense increases, blood will begin coming into Oregon from other states to satisfy the hospital demands and patient needs in Oregon. Commitment to nurses. It has been stated in previous testimony that the Red Cross is trying to eliminate nursing positions within the organization, and this is untrue. In fact, the Red Cross entered into that collective bargaining agreement with the Oregon Nurses Association, and that states that we will make every reasonable attempt to staff licensed nurses at our blood drives held in the state of Oregon, which we comply to with an average of 90% of the time, as mentioned before. Furthermore, we have just hired 5 new nurses who started this week. So in conclusion, the Red Cross respectfully opposes House Bill 2541A. We owe our communities, our volunteers, our donors, our hospitals, our licensed and our unlicensed staff members better than this bill provides. We will continue to provide the high level of care for our donors and blood recipients have come to expect nationwide as a result of our highly proficient and well-trained workforce. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. We provided a comprehensive Q&A document with our submitted written testimony. It provides further detail, including a closer look at the Q&A points. Thank you so much.
Thank you. No, we'll finish the panel and then open it up.
Chairman Sanderson, committee members, Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of BloodWorks Northwest. BloodWorks is an analogous nonprofit entity that collects blood, not unlike the American Red Cross. I think my colleagues have done an excellent job outlining our opposition arguments, so I'll adopt those and just urge your opposition. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear today.
Thank you. Senator Steiner here.
Thanks. I'm concerned about this point that you raise about recruitment difficulties. Could you talk a little bit more about what barriers you think are causing problems? I haven't heard as much problem with recruitment from a lot of other organizations that are trying to get nurses in. What can you just talk a little bit more about that? Are you using incentives? Are other organizations in those areas having trouble recruiting RNs? Can you give me a little more information?
Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, the recruitment activities of the Red Cross, many of the nurses who we recruit are new grads who come right out of nursing school and use really this opportunity as a place to learn, and then many go on to seek clinical positions that may have a small contribution in the difficulty in being able to staff.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Thank you. So why is it that the fact that you hire new grads makes it more difficult? I mean, there's a nursing school in Southern Oregon where a lot of the residents want to stay in those areas. We have them all over the state, in fact, with the remote programs that OHSU runs. I just need to really understand the difficulties that you're facing.
Senator Steiner, we can provide follow-up with that later.
That would be helpful.
Yes.
And I guess the other question is, have you all considered in some of these smaller communities offering contract positions to several of the nurses who are already, you know, on a per diem basis, nurses who are already employed at hospitals in these areas rather than having separate nurses to cover different regions. I mean, it strikes me that there might be multiple models that you could use to address this need.
Again, Senator Haber, that's a great suggestion, and we'll take that and see what we can do. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You had said that you had to train a nurse, 4 months to train a nurse, and then 9 months experience. I'd like to know a little bit about how much training you give to the rest of the staff, the phlebotomists in particular.
Madam Chair, the training for each and every person that comes to the Red Cross is the same. Whether they are a licensed or an unlicensed staff person, we're looking at roughly 11 weeks of training, and that involves classroom time, and it involves on-the-job instructor time as well, where they go out and then they perform the health histories and or the venipuncture process. So we're looking at 11 weeks, whether it's a licensed or unlicensed staff person. That level of high-quality training is for both.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments? It'd be great for you to get the answer to those questions back to us. I see no further discussion, so no one else is signed up to testify. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2541A, and colleagues, we're adjourned. Bill 2541.